You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
What did typical worship services look like in the late 19th century? We're going to learn more about that as we continue our conversations on American Lutheran sacred music with Benjamin Kologi. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University Irvine. You can learn more about Concordia University Irvine by visiting cui.edu. Joining us today, Benjamin Kologi, church organist and musicologist, author of Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947 from Concordia Publishing House. Benjamin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
This is such a fun conversation. I hope you're having fun in the conversations. I'm just picturing you like doing all the research and writing this and just having a blast while you're writing it. So we're having just as much fun asking you all the questions. This is like one of my favorite things to do, to get to like, just,
it's true.
I mean, we have questions that came up from the writing, but then in the middle of the conversation, sometimes I think of things and it's just great to get to ask an expert all my fun questions. So hopefully I'm asking the questions you, the listener, want to hear as well. Benjamin, we're going to talk more about Walther today. We talked about C.F.W. Walther last time and his influence on bringing rhythmic singing to rhythmic hymnody to American Lutheran congregations. Let's talk about what services looked like. What did worship services look like at the time of Walther? We're talking about late 19th century, right, in America?
Right. Yeah. So we talked before about the first Missouri Synod hymnal, which was 1847, a result of Walther and Trinity St. Louis publishing it themselves. I think it's important to note that the hymnal came first, 1847. Walther's liturgy did not come about until 1856. It was called the Kirchenagenda. And agenda in German just means liturgy. So that was about 9 years later that that project came about. I think you can read from that it was real, not that the liturgy was not important, but that hymnody was even more important. What the congregation sang was really important to these early Lutherans. And I think probably, I suspect there was a lot of uniformity in the liturgy. It didn't change from week to week, generally. It was easy to memorize, whereas you didn't have that with the hymnody. So I think there was an importance in getting out the hymnody first. But the liturgy, the Kirchenagenda, came out in 1856. It was a very different liturgy than what we sing in, say, LSB, Divine Service 1, 2, 3, or 4. It's much closer to Divine Service 5, which, if you know anything about that, is based off of Luther's Deutsche Messe of 1526, wherein we don't necessarily sing the Gloria in Excelsis or the Sanctus or the Agnus Dei. We sing hymns that are the equivalent of that. So instead of singing Glory be to God on high and on earth peace, goodwill, instead of singing we sing all glory be to God on high, a hymn versification of that. Same with the Sanctus. Instead of singing holy, 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 you sang, for example, you could sing Isaiah Mighty Seer in days of old. So it's a slightly different approach. And we call these things the ordinary of the liturgy, as opposed to the propers. The propers change every week. The ordinary is the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Creed, the Sanctus, Benedictus, and Agnus Dei. Those are those things that never change in the communion liturgy, at least. So Walther, in his liturgy, he kept the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Creed, the Sanctus, and the Agnus Dei. But they were hymns. So the Kyrie, actually, we can find in LSB 942. The Gloria is in LSB 947. The Creed is 954 in LSB. All of these hymns were sung every single week in the context of the liturgy. So I call these hymns of dynamic equivalence. I don't know if I came up with that or if I just heard it from somebody, but it really makes a lot of sense. You know, you're not singing exactly verbatim, glory be to God on high, but you're singing a hymn like that. And that's essentially what Luther did too. There's some differences between the Deutsche Messe and Walther's liturgy, but it's kind of the same thing. So if you look at Divine Service 5 in LSB, that's much closer to Walter's liturgy than, say, Divine Service 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Now I'm curious. This is what happens. What other liturgies were, I don't know, circulating at this time? Maybe in other Lutheran church bodies or other church bodies? I'm just curious now, the relationship of Walter's to the Deutsche Messe, but there were other variations, I suppose, of liturgy at this time?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that nobody really knows where Walter got his liturgy. There was a whole host of Reformation liturgies that had happened, 100, 150 years after the Reformation, from which liturgists could draw. People think, there's been some scholarship that Walter probably based his liturgy on a 1771 liturgical setting from Saxony, the old Saxon liturgy is what it's called. It's very similar to what Luther came up with. But, that liturgy itself was an assemblage from these other Reformation era liturgies. I think the point is that there were a lot of liturgies floating around. I think in America, of course, you have the non-German Lutheran traditions, and they didn't have a lot of influence on Walter. Walter was very careful. The early Lutherans, Missouri Synod Lutherans, are very careful not to allow other American influences in their liturgy or hymnody. One cannot simplify the liturgy outside of the LCMS. There was many. There were many synods. There was a general synod, and they all had their own problems and their own developments. They had all their own revivals of repristination of Lutheran liturgies from the 16th century, but they all had to do it in their own ways. And some of it's very interesting how they did it, but it really didn't impact a lot of Walter's thinking or their early Lutherans. They wanted to be their own ecosystem. They did not want to participate particularly in the Civil War. They were skeptical of government, and they were certainly skeptical of other church bodies.
So when it came to learning Walter's liturgy, what was the learning curve like for them to learn this liturgy? And at this time, things are still in German, correct?
Of course, yes. Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that Walter was very concerned with teaching, catechizing. We know that he taught rhythmic singing on Thursday and Friday nights, 7 to 8 p.m. So that was important. So it was equally important that the liturgy be singable. And so these hymns, all these hymns would have been known to the congregation. They would have been easy to sing. There were some responses. This is interesting that I found out. Whereas now, say, LSB, Divine Service 1, 2, or 3, we have different congregational responses, like, praise be to thee, O Lord. The congregation responds in different tune. Walter, I don't think he really thought that way. So all of the responses, the congregational responses, not the hymns, were sung to one tone. It was called the Dresden Amen. For example, the pastor would say, Der Herr sei mit euch, and the congregation would respond, Und mit deinem Geiste. Da, 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 da. That was the response to everything. And actually, it's just five notes going up the scale from G to D. It's extremely simple. And what was Walter thinking? He was thinking, well, this is what the people can learn. It's easy for them to learn. Actually, this silly little amen, I mean, it's just five notes. It's not much. But Mendelssohn uses it in his Reformation symphony. Wagner uses it in Parsifal. It was all over the musical culture, not necessarily the liturgical. Well, it was too, the liturgical, but certainly the musical culture in Germany at the time. So Walter would have had this in his ear, and probably his congregation too. So when he's thinking, how do we teach this? Well, it's an array of options. One is you make sure that you just kind of sing things that people either know in terms of the hymns or that they can learn easily. Da 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 da. So it was, Walter always approached it from a pastoral perspective. How can they learn?
What did this actually look like in practice then, doing liturgy in a congregation? Because we've got our full hymn books. They've got all that we need to follow one of these five different divine services in Lutheran service book. What did that actually look like for a congregation?
That's a great question. And I've thought a lot about it. And unfortunately, there are answers we just don't know, but we can piece together. So I've pieced together some ideas as an answer to that question. And I just preface it that way. You know, you have your theory and your hypothesis. There's evidence for this, but I doubt liturgy and hymnody was practiced the same way uniformly in all churches. So let's talk about the hymnal first. The hymnal was very small. It was about, 8 inches. You carried it with you. It was your personal hymnal, the Kirchengesangbuch of 1847. Everybody sang from that. There were prayers. There were some other things that you needed to have. So churches adopted this pretty early. So that's that. But the liturgy, you pretty much memorized. The hymnal did not have the liturgy in it. There were no printed bulletins, except for major services. So, like, for example, the dedication of Trinity St. Louis in 1865, they actually printed the liturgy, which is very interesting, has the choir anthem and everything, but that was not the case. So the congregation memorized the hymns, and they knew exactly what would happen. What's interesting, I think, is what the organist did, because the pastor was supposed to chant everything. The congregation was supposed to respond. But in order to do that, the organist had to provide modulations, which is a changing of a key from one key to the next, and transitions just from one liturgical element to the next. So from the Kyrie, which is hymn 942 and LSB, to the Gloria, he would have to change keys, get us to modulate, get into, and I say he because they were teachers. They're mostly he men at this time. He would have to modulate. He'd have to transition into the Gloria. Afterwards, he'd play a Schluss, S-C-H-L-U-S-S, which in German just means an ending. So you'd play an ending, which would take your pastor to the keynote of G. Your pastor's chanting tone was always G in the German liturgy. So the organist would have to do all of this. The only time he didn't really have to do this was during the sermon. So he could rest during the sermon. But otherwise, he was very busy. And this does not show up on paper. It doesn't show up in the agenda of 1856. It doesn't show up in the hymnal, of course, because it didn't have the liturgy in it. We just know this from later descriptions of what happened and can kind of piece it together. Another thing I do want to say is that in this ordinary, we have the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Credo. We also have a hymn in the service of the word. But it is not in the sense that we have it now, where it's like the sermon hymn or the hymn of the day. It relates to the sermon. So they would have a hymn that was sung that generally related probably to the liturgical year, wherever they were at the time. But what we would think about the hymn before or after the sermon that would relate to the hymn, it was called the console verse, the chancel verse. After the creed, the pastor would begin his sermon, but he would say, let's turn to hymn 147, we're going to sing verses 3 and 4, say. And then he might do this at the end, too. And these particular verses would relate completely to his sermon. And they were not the full hymn. They were not necessarily the first verse. They were just two or three hymns that he would select and people would turn. One suspects that oftentimes the organist was not prepared for this. The organist did not know what this hymn would be until it just kind of happened. But I think that's a tradition of the Walter liturgy, the German liturgy, that we have nothing like that anymore. Where I suppose some creative pastors in their sermon can work in a hymn and say, hey, turn to this hymn, let's sing it. But that's not our regular tradition, but it was then. It was to sing a couple verses at the beginning and or at the end, which is a unique feature of this liturgy.
Fascinating.
It is.
We're talking with Benjamin Clogy, church organist and musicologist, on his book, American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947, from Concordia Publishing House. And we'll continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
At Concordia University Irvine, you have the freedom to explore your future and your faith. Across over 60 on-campus and online programs, you'll experience Christian education that's uniquely designed to develop the whole person, to prepare you not just for your career, but for all of your callings in life. Here you'll explore life's toughest questions, gain lifelong skills, and make relationships that last a lifetime. Concordia University Irvine. Learn more at cui.edu.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
Today we're talking with Benjamin Clogy, church organist and musicologist, taking a look at his book, Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947. And we're talking about Walther's liturgy today. Great respect for both the pastor and the organist, the cantor.
Yeah.
Putting together all the preparations that were needed, and sometimes having to improvise probably even during the service, depending on what the pastor's preaching on, right? So we've talked a little bit about the pastor's responsibilities during the liturgy, the organist. Did anyone else have responsibilities in the liturgy during the time of Walther and his liturgy?
Well, the short answer to that is no. The theological answer is, well, the congregation is the important part, participant in the liturgy, aren't they? But your question as to who leads the liturgy, well, it was the office of the pastor and the cantor, who was also the teacher. He was the school teacher. Both of them were trained. They were the only ones who were trained in theology, in music in many cases, both of them. So they were the two leaders of the congregation. There were no assistant music directors. There was no assistant choir directors. There were no praise bands. Nothing like that. It was these two people who bore the responsibility, and it was a spiritual responsibility. And that's why these Addison Seminary professors would write week after week or month after month, depending on when the thing was published during the years, about how important this job is that you organists have. It is a ministry of the word. You work with the pastor. This is very important to do. So, there weren't choirs in the sense that the choir would sing an anthem. They would lead the singing. And oftentimes, that's how a congregation would learn the rhythmic tunes that Walther wanted them to learn. Through a subset of the congregation, which became the choir, and eventually this became secondhand to the congregation. But I think that bespeaks the importance of the office of the cantor and organist. He did that on Sundays, probably on Saturdays too, he would prepare, and was teaching 5 days a week. And I know the pastors were no less busy. But this was a parish needed these both of these fellows to do their jobs in order to run effectively.
Mm-hmm. So many questions about the culture of how this all worked. I'm just thinking, and you may or may not know this because I'm not sure that this is even in your book, but I'm just thinking of logistically how this works with a congregation. You have a pastor, you have your cantor, you have the congregation, and then the smaller subset of the choir. How big of congregations were a lot of these congregations at this point? Because the LCMS is still fairly baby at this point. If you have a subset of your congregation singing in the choir, was that like half of the congregation or something? I don't know. I'm just really curious.
So I suppose you have to make the distinction between the country parishes and the city parishes.
That's true.
So look at the Gesamtgemeinde. That was the four parishes in St. Louis. It was Holy Cross, Zion, Emmanuel, and Trinity. And they were all kind of run by C.F.W. Walter behaving as a bishop. You can dissect that word, but, you know, that's essentially what he was in practice. And so these congregations were very large. They were very active. They were associated with the seminary, because the seminary was right across the field from Holy Cross. So you had large churches. You had Trinity, Milwaukee, very large. So these churches could afford, had the ability to field choirs, a subset of the congregations. I suspect in your average country church, they did not have choirs. I don't think that even crossed their mind. If you think about how busy these cantors were, I am sure they were just happy with the minimum. And so I suspect they didn't exist in many, if not most, places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. Someday maybe we'll know the answers to all of these random questions of historical significance. So were there differences in opinions on how the liturgy should be run? I mean, Walter had his liturgy. I don't know. I'm just curious if there were other theologians or cantors.
Lutherans have different opinions.
I know, right? I don't know. Were there healthy debates going on about what this should actually look like in the church?
I think you'd have to narrow that down to the era that you're talking about.
Ah,
because certainly by the end of the 19th century, you're talking about the development of the common service. And just suffice it to say, the common service was like Divine Service 3. Mm-hmm. That's very different from Walter's liturgy, and that was the 1880s. So you had a lot of discussion at that point. But remember, Walter ran a very tight ship, and I don't know that there was a lot of debate. His liturgy was published well into the 20th century by CPH. That was the official, and in the constitution of the LCMS, in order to join the LCMS, you had to agree to use these hymnals that were doctrinally pure. So that excluded a lot of other options. So I suspect that he didn't entertain a lot of that. But you certainly see after his death, and just historical forces happen, right? I mean, the introduction of English was the main one, but by the 1880s, 90s, the Lutherans were having to interact with the English people. It was just what was happening. And there was just questions. And that was after Walter's life. So late 19th century, early 20th century, you see these struggles in other ways that are really fascinating, but probably beyond what we have time for here.
Where do we see then the liturgy, the influence of Walter in hymnals and services today? Where has that persisted?
In the liturgy, I would say not much. And I think that is because of the transition to English, mm-hmm. which certainly was underway by the late 19th century. World War I really moved that along. And by World War II, German was really less. And you have the Lutheran hymnal. You had the Lutheran hymnals in English in 1912. And then, of course, in 1941, the Lutheran hymnal, all in English. So you saw that. And just necessarily, a German language liturgy is not going to move on to that. Now, I suppose if someone had wanted, they could have translated the thing. But historical forces were such that it didn't happen. They moved into English. There were English resources. Catherine Winkworth translated so many of the hymns, for example. She did a great job translating the hymns into English in many cases, let's say 85% of the time, really preserving the Orthodox Lutheran hymns as hymns. So in that case, you didn't really need the German anymore. And sadly, it was kind of the Walter liturgy was rather rendered obsolete, even though it was used in many quarters. I would say up to World War II, it was used in some quarters. But after that, we don't know it. Like I said before, Divine Service 5 is similar to Walter's liturgy, but is not the same. So I think it's rather obsolete. It is a historical anachronism now. But it's fun to think about how people worshiped using that liturgy and those hymns.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah. Now, moving, we mentioned just briefly about the other hymnals moving a little bit further into history. Was there interplay between some of the different Lutheran synods in America at this time, especially getting into English for the creation of hymnals? Because at the beginning, you know, Walther wanted his own hymnal for this church body. Was there kind of more interplay between other synods at this point moving forward into history?
Yeah, certainly there was. That's a great question. I am not an expert on that, and I don't go into that particularly in my book because, you know, you had the conference, and there were fewer differences in synods back then in the 19th century. I mean, they thought there were. They fought over their differences, but certainly not in terms of these days. You did have that, but it really wasn't until the 20th century where you began to have collaboration. Really, if you want to take the question further to where something I can actually talk about, it was Lutheran Book of Worship, LBW, in 1978. That was the first time, really, that all of the synods, I mean, most of them, there's never all, had collaborated to put together a hymnal. And Heinrich Melchior Muhlenberg, the patriarch of American Lutheranism in America, when he came over in the 18th century, he had a desire for a Lutheran hymnal for all Lutherans to use. And it never happened until, and it didn't happen even then, Lutheran Book of Worship in 1978, which the LCMS had initiated in the 1960s. Other American Lutheran had become involved. And of course, the LCMS pulled out of that project at the end, so it was not a pan-Lutheran hymnal in the end, but that was the closest to a pan-Lutheran hymnal as we ever got. And Carl Schalk and Richard Hillert were greatly involved in the in that hymnal. But no, nothing beyond that.
You have, you're going to be in St. Louis. So those who are listening to this series and enjoying our conversations might have the opportunity to join you for a special event here in St. Louis. We mentioned it briefly last week. I want to mention again this week because it's coming up very soon, September 21st. Tell us a little bit about that event.
Right. We are going to have a very fun organ recital and Vespers that I'm playing at Our Redeemer in Overland, Missouri, on September 21st at 3 p.m. So I'm going to do a brief organ recital, then we're going to do Vespers from the hymnal, and then I'm going to do a presentation on my book. I will try not to be too boring.
September 21st, Our Redeemer in Overland. We'll share a link to that event in our show notes, program notes today as well. Our guest, Benjamin Kloge, church organist and musicologist, author of Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947, from Concordia Publishing House. Benjamin, thank you so much for today's conversation. Looking forward to next time.
Thanks. It's been fun.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.